You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if you have a problem figuring out if you're for Biden or Trump, then you ain't crazy. Because Jesus, are those really our choices? I'm your host, Justin Emelzeski, and I'm sure you know where I stand on everything. It's where I stood after the last election, and I can't imagine my stance changing over the next, let's just say, rest of my life election cycles. Hashtag don't vote 2020. And I think my co-hosts agree with me, at least one of them, so let's bring them in. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
To be clear, the Libertarians did nominate a candidate this weekend by the name of Joe Jurgensen, who is a female woman, Joe, J-O, no E, who is a lecturer, Justin, of psychology at Clemson.
Damn it!
So,
vote for Joe 2020. Wait, so they just wanted
now,
to run...
Wow, we just converted Justin to an identitarian. He doesn't care as long as you're from Clemson.
I'm obviously being facetious. I have no idea what Joe Jurgensen stands for except for body lotion. So just gonna figure that out. But did the Libertarians just want to run a Clemson Tiger before the Republicans did? Is that what this is?
Yeah, I think that was their real goal here. No, they actually picked a candidate this year who I think has been, you know, part of the Libertarian Party, as opposed to a celebrity candidate like Justin Amash or Gary Johnson. So we'll see if they can break that 1% threshold. Good luck to the Libertarians.
You know what I was referring to, right? Or who I was referring to?
No. What?
Oh, Nikki Haley.
Oh.
She went to Clemson.
She's a Clemson alum?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought she just was a governor of South Carolina.
She's both.
You can be both?
Yeah, you can go to Clemson and succeed at things besides football. I don't know if you heard, Daniel.
I was unaware that such things existed, so fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, let's bring in our other co-host. Identifying from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his gay white male privilege, William Green.
Hello. We got an exciting week coming up. Happy Memorial Day to everyone as you listen to this on Monday, if Justin remembers to post the show. The New York Times is celebrating.
Wait. When do I forget to post the show?
To Patreon.
Oh, yeah, Patreon, that's true. But it's available for free
time,
everywhere.
Yeah.
I just forget to charge people.
Time.
I forget that I just assume people don't want to give us money for this, and then I remember, oh shit, I better post it today, because if I post two in 1 week, people are going to be like, why are we being charged twice a week when this is a weekly show?
Very true. But the New York Times editorial board is celebrating Memorial Day this year by asking, why does the U.S. military celebrate white supremacy? So we were trying to figure out that out before the show. Why does the military celebrate white supremacy? But there's more than just farce coming up. I'm sure you guys have seen it's all over the mainstream news. Wednesday, Crew Dragon Demo 2, the first astronauts being carried by a private company into space will happen. Hopefully, if weather provides something more than 40% surety, because that's what it's at right now. Last time I checked, 40%. Chance of weather violation. Justin, can you clear that weather out of Florida so we can launch these astronauts into space on Wednesday?
Oh, is that where they're leaving from? Is it the Kennedy Space Center they're leaving from?
Yes, sir.
Oh, maybe I'll take a trip.
Yep, instantaneous launch at 4:33 p.m. But like I said, right now it's 40% chance of weather violation.
Well, what is it that they're worried about, the afternoon thunderstorms in Florida? Those happen at about 4 p.m. every day. So you said the launch is 4:30. It should be clear by then.
Yeah.
Yeah, it should be clear by then.
Yeah. They'll have to have clear weather an hour out and then 30 minutes out and then 10 minutes out. So.
Oh, they won't have it an hour out.
There's certain constraints that have to be met at each checkpoint. So
in the summer, it rains at like 3 to 4 p.m. every day for like 15 minutes, and then it stops and it's clear. What happens if the launch gets pushed back?
Different windows. Yeah, there's different windows. Basically, someone's going to correct me if I say this wrong. I think it's every like 13 hours or something like that. Like I don't remember exactly. It's some number of hours they can relaunch. So there'll be a launch window the next day. They can keep delaying it by a day, basically.
Why is that? Months. Is it like government paperwork? Like, I don't understand why they can't just be, let's just delay this an hour and go. Like,
well, the space station is only moving at like a bajillion meters per second. So,
it's the space station's fault.
So it's not like it's always lined up. That's why it's an instantaneous launch as well. It has to launch at exactly that time to meet the space station.
Fucking physics. Also, isn't every launch instantaneous?
Not the launches, but not the launch window. In other words, the in order to get a proper orbit, sometimes the window can be several hours long. But for International Space Station launch, unless you have some magical fuel, you have exactly enough fuel to launch at exactly the right time.
What if you don't have magical fuel, but you have a magic school bus?
Then I'd imagine your launch window is pretty open.
I had no idea any of this was happening. I don't know about you, Daniel, but I was very distracted this week. Did you have any idea any of this was happening, Daniel?
Yeah, I knew it was happening. I didn't know with the precision that our co-host did, but very excited about it.
To be fair, our co-host is probably more precise than everyone else involved in the project.
Well, I'll definitely be watching the SpaceX stream on YouTube and tweeting out my comments. Like I said, with a 40% chance of violation, it may not even happen. But on that day, but it will happen very soon. So very exciting.
All right, and you know what's going to happen very soon, and we need to do instantaneously the rest of this show. So let's get on to it.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals.
Before we roll into the news this week, why don't you check us out on patreon.com/themidside, where Justin posts the show sometimes, and then you give us a couple bucks every time he remembers to do that. We also do some Patreon-exclusive content from time to time, patreon.com/themidside, which I promise you is not a right-wing trap, unlike believing all women.
Hey, when you believe all women, Daniel, does Admiral Akbar come out?
Yes, I think that's a requirement now. So a New York Times op-ed this week was, well, let's say it was mocked ruthlessly on the internets because it declared that the hashtag believe all women that has been going around for a few years now is actually manufactured by the right and is a trap. In a piece titled Believe All Women is a Right-Wing Trap, journalist Susan Faludi began by claiming that conservatives are having a field day ever since Tara Reid came forward with her sexual assault allegations against former Vice President Joe Biden.
Past these names. What's her name? Susan Faludi and Tara Reid?
Susan Faludi.
Doug Faludi's wife?
Faludi. she says that, quote, feminists have been caught in a new hypocrisy trap, noting that the silence or defense of the presumptive Democratic nominee in comparison to the battle cries that were made on behalf of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford during Brett Kavanaugh's SCOTUS confirmation in 2018. She says, quote, in fact, Believe All Women does have an asterisk. It's never been feminist boilerplate. What we are witnessing is another instance of the right decrying what it imagines the American women's movement to be, Faludi claimed, insisting that the all in the pro-women slogan was added by right-wing commentary. Faludi went on to observe that the hashtag Believe All Women is, quote, by a wide margin used mostly by its detractors. So her key distinguishing point here, Justin. Now, please jump in when you think that you need to scream very loudly, is that there is a major difference between the right-wing trap of hashtag believe all women and the much more precise feminist version of hashtag believe women. So, Justin, what I ask you is, what's it all about?
I thought the Hokey Pokey was what it was all about.
In a sense, yes. But go on.
I thought there was more to the argument. She doesn't explain the difference between believe all women and believe women.
Well, she goes on to say that believe women is a rejection of the historical concept of hashtag doubt women. I don't know why she had to put a hashtag in there. And the idea here is that women should be listened to and believed and given their due process, etc., as opposed to what historically had happened. But hashtag believe all women means something totally different from that that I can't distinguish.
Here's the problem. The problem is believe women and believe all women mean the same thing linguistically. The all is just redundant. You wouldn't need to say it. Because if you're saying believe women, you mean believe all women, because you're not saying any subset of the category. Anybody who fits the traits of a woman, and we're not going to go into that because that's a whole other fucking controversial thing, but whatever your definition of a woman, we'll even say that, whatever your definition of a woman is. So if a chair is a woman to you, we would believe the chair. Okay? Because you're just saying believe women. So that means anyone who fits that category is believed. But then if you're saying believe all women, maybe you're doing it for rhetorical purposes, Daniel. And maybe that's the argument here, is that the right is attacking them on rhetorical grounds to make them sound absurd. But if you look at the argument just presented, the need to say believe women is in itself a rhetorical attack. And that's what the right is trying to get at. And what I mean by that is, if it really is that every accusation should be investigated seriously and given its day in court if it deserves it, then that's the basis of the American justice system. That's the basis of the American judicial system. The idea that you make an accusation, the police investigate it, and then if there is enough evidence, it moves forward into trial. Or, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs. I just watch a lot of Law and Order, so maybe you can talk about that. But, you know, once Ice-T is done with you, then it moves forward to, you know, any of the ADAs, right? So there really is no difference. This is all just a pivot. This is all just a pivot. It's a pivot because they need to backwards rationalize, and we talked about this last episode, and I said this, you know, the last edition of the Midside. They need to backwards rationalize that they're supporting Biden, even though they've tried to, quote unquote, cancel every other guy who's been accused of anything. And that's what the left does. That is what the left has always done. They've done that my entire life, and it's not a surprise they're doing this. This is just all part of the rhetorical game that goes on and on and on in circles, where all you have to do is say the other person is evil and paint the other side as evil. That's the game. This is the game. It hasn't been this extreme my entire life, but this is our life now, and this is going to be our life for the rest of our lives, unless we stop acknowledging it and we stop taking it as serious, because this isn't serious. I don't know if anyone heard that. My Siri just tried to go off because I said serious. But, and William, I'll toss it to you once I finish this one statement right here. They have always done this. Go back on what you think for what's pragmatically correct, and then try to make the other side look bad, because if you make the other side look bad, other people are going to be too ashamed to be on that side. That's the entire rhetorical game of our entire culture right now. William?
Well, it's certainly serious for the guys involved, right?
Yes.
That being said,
I didn't mean the accusations weren't serious. I meant the rhetorical game is not serious.
Yeah. And it's funny, even the quotes in this article disprove this person's pretzel logic attempt at an argument, right? The actual tweets listed, these are people that have said these things, right? That have said, believe all women. And that's what it's really implied. This is all about, like you said, backwards rationalization, but it's also gaslighting, right? We've talked about it before. This is actually trying to tell people what they saw, what they observed, the whole movement as played out in the media was false, right? You can't believe what we said 5 minutes ago. This is, you know, you're the one that caused this, right? It's so right. Weird.
It's certainly gaslighting if they're intending to represent the entire movement or group or whatever. But that's also the problem with our collectivistic tribal culture right now, is we take every person's argument as representing whatever group they share ideas with. So maybe this person, let's be generous for a second, maybe this person never did like the rhetoric of believe all women. Maybe they never did like the rhetoric of cancel everyone. Based on the way this was written, I don't think that's true. But we jumped to that conclusion. And Daniel, I'm going to ask you a question rather than you asking us a question. We're going to flip this on you for a second. As one of the 100 people in the world with the rhetorician in his Twitter bio, I want to ask you, isn't this all just a rhetorical game? Isn't the gaslighting Williams talking about is a rhetorical game? Wasn't the point I was making, wasn't that about the rhetorical game that's going on here?
Yeah, it's a rhetorical game called subversion. You may recognize this term, Justin, from Clemson and a professor there who pioneered this nonsense tactic, or at least
not
popularized
the one running
it.
For president as a libertarian, to be clear.
Correct. Not Joe Jorgensen. I misspoke earlier. Not Jorgensen. Jorgensen.
No, Joe you said Joe. Jorgensen. I just made a joke.
Oh, okay. But the idea here is that once anything has taken a position of power, I'm speaking abstractly here, that thing must be destroyed. And so in this case, that position of power is a truth. Truth, it can be something that is oppressive and powerful, and especially when that truth is being used against the people who are using it against other people. So now that thing has to be destroyed. It has to be subverted. So we take a rhetorical tactic and we say, no, no, no. You say believe all women. We never said believe all women. We just said believe women, and that's totally different. So let's move along here. There's nothing to see. Vote for Joe Biden because, you know, he'll give us more power. And it's all a rhetorical tactic, as you were saying, and it's one that's clear. But the problem is we live in a time on both the right and left. Trump is the quintessential example of this on the new right.
Yes.
Where you can say the absurd thing. You can be blatantly rhetorical in this sense, and it doesn't matter anymore, because all people want is for their own edification, for their own emotional quelling. They want something. And it doesn't even matter if that something feels good, is truthful, is right. As long as it's something that can take that burden off of them, then they're fine with it. Trump does it all the time. The left does it all the time. We are in this post-truth world where rhetoric is the most important thing that there is. So in some ways, the sophists have finally had their day in the sun, Justin. Finally, it is the sophist's time to rule.
Yeah, and that's scary because I want to tweak something you said just a little bit. I think everything you said was very well taken. And I do agree we're in post-truth. But what post-truth leads to is post-values. So even though they act like they're pursuing values, it's exactly what you just said. It's really all about power, not values. No one's concerned about what the values are they're pursuing. They're just concerned about, oh, I feel like I'm in power. I feel like I'm in charge. I feel like I'm important.
It's right. In fact, I will go one step further to add to your argument, which is it's not just not pursuing values. It's the act of destruction of values that you lead to nihilism, which is that not only are we not pursuing values, no values are allowed to be had. We must destroy them. And that is what we are trying to, quote unquote, achieve.
Because if you only have power that you're after, then the easiest way to achieve power is not to raise yourself up. It's to destroy everybody else. Because if you're focused on raising yourself up and everybody else is raising themselves up, the level of competition is so much higher. But if you're focused on destroying everybody else, you get pretty low. And I mean, that's how we end up with Biden versus Trump, right, William?
Yeah. Yay.
Yeah.
Versus Jorgensen. So, William, I think what, you know, gets left here, as you said, obviously the accusations are harmful to people. But now what about, we can say people like Tara Reid, but even if you don't believe Tara Reid or Blasey Ford, people whose claims now are going to be used for political purposes purely, those actual victims, if they are victims, are now just essentially political pawns based on which side wants to hold them up. Hashtag it's sad, but if you'd like to respond, you can say anything you want.
Well, yeah, I think the truth here is somewhere on the midside. So welcome to the midside, everyone. We should be judging people's accusations based on the evidence they present, not based on their sex, not based on their political ideas, not based on their purported values, you know, what they claim their values to be. We should be looking at the evidence and their character. Gasp. We should be judging them, the victims. And that sounds so awful, right? But that's exactly what you have to do. And does that mean that someone who has a past that is checkered and untrustworthy and that may be mentally unstable or present conflicting evidence that we may not believe them at first? Absolutely. But, you know, to quote the X-Files, the truth is out there. So if the evidence is on their side, the evidence, you know, will come out. I mean, that's the way things work in reality. We can't judge people based on just what they, when they spout off arbitrary statements, right? And this has nothing to do with, this also means at the same time, you can still be compassionate to those people, right? If they truly are victims, they do deserve some compassion and some interest. But you also need to judge their motivation. And that isn't a woman thing. That is a victim of any crime thing. You have to judge their motivation. And that's what the police are supposed to do in cases like this.
The farce in there and what you said, William, is what has been hit especially hard the past 5 years, but just in general, by the left and by our society, by the media, is compassion is what makes people human. Compassion is what makes us human. But I don't agree with that. I'm just saying that that's what they're saying. And then, as you're pointing out, they throw all compassion out the window when it comes to this. And that is what is so funny to me. And that is the ultimate hypocrisy to me. If you want to argue that this is a battle between what's more compassionate, is it more compassionate to vote for Joe Biden because that would be better for the country than it is to support Tara Reid over him? That's a discussion that would be interesting if compassion is your root value. But this isn't actually about compassion. And when they use compassion in that way, it goes to what Daniel's saying about it's just emotionalism and they're just using that compassion to make you feel bad to gain their own power. And that's what's funny to me about all of this, is the focus on compassion is dead.
I personally wonder what Al Franken thinks of all this, since he seems to be the one lefty who did get thrown under the bus for doing far less than what Joe Biden is accused of doing. But
I know, think about that. His picture with, like, what was it with the... what jacket did he have on? It was like a bulletproof vest or something that woman had on?
A flak jacket on. And he
flak
was,
jacket, that was the word.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he like put his hands in front of it. Where Joe Biden, at the very least, we have pictures of him like sniffing people's hair creepily. Like, I'm not saying either of those are sexual assault or either of those are a crime. But if we're going after like who actually did something that shows less character, the comedian making a sexual joke that harmed nobody, or the presidential candidate sniffing people's hair.
swimming nude in front of his Secret Service, his female Secret Service officers. That's a confirmed story. That's fun. Yeah, Joe Biden's not a great person. Donald Trump is clearly not a great person. So hashtag don't vote 2020. Or vote for Joe if you want to.
Hashtag go one. Tigers.
I have seen that recently, by the way. It's hashtag vote for Joe. Hashtag not that one. I thought it was funny. Other things that are funny in Corona news. Air travel. You thought it was bad before. Oh, boy.
I love how, Daniel, before you go into the details of this, I love how if you look at the history of air travel, it just gets worse and worse. Like, it started out, like, people would, like, wear suits and, like, get nice food and, like, be all proper to each other. And then it, like, eventually ended up with, like, we're going to take pigs on the plane and they're going to shit on everyone. And now they're like, wait, how can we make this worse? And now we have this story.
The, libertarian in me make sure that we want to say that the extent to which government has been involved in air travel is the extent to which it's gotten shittier. So, congratulations, everyone. We're about to add a whole new layer of manure. A new age of air travel is taking shape, the Wall Street Journal reports. Airports and airlines are rolling out temperature checks for crew and, increasingly, passengers, as well as thermal scans to spot people with elevated body temperatures. Face masks are now de rigueur for travelers across the U.S. Passengers on Europe's biggest budget carrier must raise their hands to use the toilet. Forget about the perks of priority boarding at Air France. The carrier is one of several boarding passengers seated at the back of the aircraft first, which, by the way, makes sense in all cases, but in this case, to limit traffic jams in the aisles. Many airlines are removing in-flight magazines, scrapping meal services on shorter routes, and parking the duty-free cart. Getting off the plane at the end of the flight could take even longer than usual as airlines try to control the typical crush, with some taking flight attendants, having them give cues to small groups for when it's time to stand up, and a panoply of other things. The Trump administration is even preparing to roll out temperature checks by the TSA. So if you thought waiting in line to throw away your 4-ounce bottles of orange juice was a pain, now the TSA will be checking your temperature. So, well, this sounds horrible, and Justin, I'm going to be flying a few times coming up here soon, and I look forward to the hell that is the theatrical virus protection that the TSA will provide. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, we've gone into that before, how the masks are theater just like the TSA is theater. I'm just glad that next time I have a giant water bottle, I have something else to do with it besides chug it and then, like, have my bladder hurt for the next 24 hours of my life, because you can actually poison yourself with water. I have confirmed this. I was in line at the airport with my fiance, and of course she bought water before she got in line. And then she was like, wait, I have to throw this away. And you know the way I am. I'm like Adam Carolla, where I don't want to waste anything. So I was like, hey, don't throw that away. I'll drink it. Worst idea ever. Okay? If you've ever had to feel like, if you've ever wanted to feel like you have to go to the bathroom but can't actually go, chug a shitload of water, because that's what it feels like. It's excruciating pain, but when you try to go to the bathroom, nothing happens, and that lasts for like 24 hours. But now, if they're going to check my temperature, and the water is colder than 98.5 degrees, I'm just going to pour it on my head, because there's no way I'll be too warm then.
Yeah, Justin, because you're so damn hot. You gotta bring that temperature down before you get on that plane.
But no, here's the thing about this. Before, like, we shit all over this, there's actually something, there's one thing in all of this I like.
Hmm.
I like the idea that they're going to tell us when we can leave the plane. You want to know why? Because there are always those fucking people on the plane who they're in the back, right? So I buy tickets in the back or in the middle because they're cheaper. But then there's always that one fucking guy who needs to get out before everyone else. And, like, three rows behind you are standing up, so he stands up and, like, pushes by you. Or, like, you stand up and you're pulling your bag out of the overhead compartment, and he, like, pushes by you while you're doing that, because he fucking needs to get off the plane first. Even though he didn't want to pay for that privilege, he does that. So that's going to control that to a certain extent. So I do think that that's, like, they're backing into a measure here that they should have always done. But it's because, Daniel, we're moving into a society where they're treating us more like children more and more every day. You have to raise your hand to go to the bathroom on the fucking airplane? Like, are you serious?
I think you probably hit the call button, although that is technically still raising your hand.
But the point is, we're now living in a time where everyone else knows better than us, and we have to be regulated and taken care of. There's no individual efficacy anymore. No one's an adult. It's like I said, it went from like people wearing suits and getting nice meals and treating each other with respect to you're all fucking children in sandals and socks and sweatpants who are just going to stand in the aisle and push by each other, so you have to push the call button to do anything. Am I insane, William, or is this insane?
This is pretty insane. I can't imagine this lasting for very long, because we'll get another one of those. Who was it, Dr. Wong or Dr. Lee? Who was the doctor that got his face smashed?
Yeah, but people took his side, remember?
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. People are going to, someone's going to rebel. Some Karen is going to either anti-rebel or someone else is going to rebel, and people are going to take their side, and this will come to an end.
Yeah, the part I'm not looking forward to at all, by the way, is the wearing a face mask on the entire flight, which is a requirement.
Daniel, I think
they're supposed to.
I think what we should do is just take some of those blankets and make like a little fort, and make sure the air vent is inside of your fort. You know, hang it from the air vent, and that way you can have your own little private space, and then make sure the armrest is inside of it too. And then you can have your own little cocoon with your own air vent, and you know you can press the call button whenever you're going to go to the bathroom. And
you ever seen those old timey tubs that have the shower curtain that goes all the way around them? Like,
yeah,
in the ceiling?
Yes.
Let's do that.
Let's do that. Let's just hammer home the whole mask thing. You are in a tube using recycled air, recycled everything, right? The face mask, unless you're wearing some sort of like N95 mask and completely sealed, the things that are in that air are going into your lungs at some point. You're not going to hold your breath for a 4.5 hour flight. You're going to touch things other people have touched. And don't even get me started about the people wearing gloves. It's so disgusting. It's so disgusting, people who are wearing gloves. You know why it's disgusting? They're never changing them.
That's true.
Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, so I went to a restaurant the other day, a fast food restaurant. I won't say which one as to not super shame them, because I do like them, but they didn't know what to do with their gloves. They had no idea what to do with procedures with gloves. So the guy was wearing, first he was touching stuff without gloves, and then he sort of had that, oh, I gotta wear gloves. So he'd put on gloves. He'd touch a bunch of things, and then he'd go and like touch stuff that other people have touched, and then he would go, oh, I gotta change gloves, and then he would change the gloves, but he would hold the gloves in his hand, like ball them up and put them in his hand and throw them away. And the whole glove routine to me just seemed like it was some nuanced mockumentary that I was watching that really got the satire.
Yeah, I'm just glad with all this stuff on airplanes that that means we've figured out how to make the plane fly as safely as possible. Because when I'm in the air, I think the most dangerous part of being in the air is that I'm inside a mechanical device that if it fails, I would die immediately on impact. Like, why are we freaking out over like the most minimal possible risk on the plane? Oh, there are trip hazards on the plane. Yeah, that's what you worry about when you get on a fucking airplane. Is that the plane taking off and landing safely? Like, Jesus.
Yeah, it's all going to be fun. I'm flying to Nashville with my wife in early June. And then I'm flying to Vegas by myself in July. And then we're flying to Florida in late July. So quite a few flights coming up here.
Oh, and by the way, you just reminded me. The mask thing isn't going to last, Daniel. So I was in Disney Springs where you had to wear the mask the other day because they opened. So I was like, I'm going to go to Disney Springs because I fucking can. First of all, unless they have a monitoring system like Big Brother, and I mean that very literally, people were walking around without masks on. So that's the first thing is people just aren't following the rules. The second thing is, have you tried to wear a mask all the time in the summer? I didn't know your lips and outside of your nose could sweat. I sweat in places I didn't know I could sweat. It was the most uncomfortable thing. It wasn't the breathing. It was the sweating. And then the final thing is here, I got something for you. And I asked my friend, I asked Elliot, you know, who used to be a co-host here, who works at Disney. I asked him, so if I buy like a snack food and carry it around and take a bite like once every 5 minutes, do I have to wear my mask? Because if somebody asks me, I can just say I'm eating while I'm walking around. I will pay the $5 tax to not have to wear a mask if that's how I get away with it.
It's very true. I don't know if I'm just experiencing minor claustrophobia or if there's something legit here, if it's psychosomatic. But after some time wearing the mask, the only time I've worn it extensively is I went downtown to pick up some furniture out of my office and had to wear it almost the entire time. And I got lightheaded. Like, it felt, I don't know, it's not like oxygen deprivation, I guess, but I don't know. Maybe it was just purely psychosomatic, but I felt very lightheaded, and the moment I took it off and was breathing real air, it went away. So
you have the coronavirus.
No. I've had antibody testing, and there's only a 10% chance that they're totally wrong. So I don't have it.
Well, no, that's something we talked about as well, and we don't want to go too deep here. So we'll end this in a second and go on to what everyone actually wants to hear about. That's something we talked about before, the unintended consequences of all this. And that's the Adam Carolla principle, where if everyone's using hand sanitizer, well, that means their immune system isn't as strong. If everyone's showering all the time, that means their natural defenses aren't as strong. Well, it's going to be the same thing here. If we need a breathing aid all the time, well, what's going to happen? Our breathing isn't going to be as strong because we're going to need this breathing aid the whole time. And that's what you're talking about, Daniel. It's fundamentally changing the way your body's operating, which is crazy.
I don't know what the science is behind it. I know when I was wearing it for an extended period of time, I just started getting really lightheaded and got a headache and had to take it off and was breathing better.
You don't need to be like a fucking scientist to figure it out, though. If you're putting a filter between two devices, it changes the way the devices receive things. So one device is your lungs, the other device is trees. That's how you get oxygen. If you put a fucking filter in between them, you're getting your oxygen differently. It's not fucking rocket science.
I don't know. I'm going to ask Elon. What do you think?
What is it? An instantaneous mask?
All right. Let's give the people what they want.
Yeah, let's give the people what they want. Let's talk about it. Hit the music here, William. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off. Wasn't focused on. If you want to listen to us record live, these episodes are released as non-live episodes. I edit them and then I release them. Like, for instance, the cat was yelling earlier. I'll probably take that out. You can join our Discord. Join our Discord at themidside.com/podcast. You can just click on any episode. The link's there. You can listen to us record live. You can talk to us during the week. And they now have like video and screen sharing. So I don't know, maybe I'll start doing some like live video where people can like talk and hang out and stuff. Does that sound fun to you, William?
Sounds great. Last weekend, or up until Wednesday, that we can play Valorant, and then that goes live next week. But I've been grabbing people on Discord to play. It's been fun.
There you go. He just said a whole bunch of stuff that I don't understand. Is that a game your company is developing?
Yep, it's tactical hero-based shooter, and it's a lot of fun. Launches June 2nd. Hashtag not a sponsor.
I was going to say, how did this go from plugging our own Discord to plugging the company you work for?
It's called My Privilege.
Thought you were... Never mind. I was going to say you're identifying as a woman to forego that privilege, but... Okay,
that's not
so
one of the privileges listed.
Okay, so this is the art section, the Hopeful Romantic with JML, and I want to talk about a couple very important things with art for me. We're going to leave the bigger one for second because that's going to be a longer discussion. I actually think the second one is relevant to some of the stuff we've already talked about in this episode, to which if you're a Snyder Cut supporter and you're listening to this, you might go, what the hell is he talking about? But we'll get to that in a second.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Yeah, because I said spoiler cut. That's a Snyder Cut that's a spoiler. But spoiler cut is funny. But first I want to talk about, as we're recording this, Daniel, the day before we're recording this, so yesterday when we were recording this, 2 days ago, if you're listening to this on release day, was the 10-year anniversary of the series finale of Lost. Now,
what's Ron, that? I don't acknowledge such a thing.
Okay, well, that's what I want to talk about here, right? Why don't you acknowledge such a thing?
It rejected everything the show was about and was generally an atrocity to art, to writing, to acting, to cinematography, to... Just kidding. It was bad.
I think it was mainly bad writing-wise. And yes, I think it was bad writing-wise because it was bad philosophically. I don't know if production we can really fault it. But I do think
that there was a flying punch by Jack that needed to go in the ending and did not. So,
well, everything with Jack needed to go, ideally, right? Because that's ultimately, I think, 10 years later, right? This was a very formative show for me. Was it a formative show for you?
In terms of my TV consumption and understanding the importance of ideas in art, yes.
Yes, I agree completely. Especially because if you look at, like, you know, it was influenced by Watchmen. Lindelof has since gone on to do a Watchmen show. Carlton Cuse has since gone on to do a bunch of other shows that are phenomenal. And you look at the romanticism in this show and the romanticism in science fiction and everything that's happened since. I think this was a very formative show. Now, what's interesting here and what really spurred this discussion for me is Rotten Tomatoes had an article. And they said, hear us out. Lost was always heading to that finale, and it was great. Now, I agree in hindsight that it was always heading to that finale. But we just didn't realize who Damon Lindelof was. Now that we know, it's really obvious that it was heading to that finale. But was it great? No, it was not great. And I want to explain why. Because what's really interesting about this article is, I think for the first time ever, we have explicit quotes that confirm what I said when it came out 10 years ago, Daniel. So, the first was Carlton Cuse. Lost was metaphorically about lost people looking for meaning in their lives, so the ending had to be a spiritual one that explained these characters' journey and destiny. Agree with that. I don't think either of us can disagree with that, right?
Correct.
But here's the thing. Carlton Cuse since has shown that the way he prefers making shows is to partner with someone, where someone has a vision and he helps bring that vision to life. When you look at things like The Strain, or you look at Bates Motel, which phenomenal show, Bates Motel. He is helping with that and helping it be better. And I think that's what he did here with a lot of the storytelling and the pacing and the execution of it. And we all know Sawyer was his favorite character. But in there, does it say what the spirituality is? Does it say what the philosophy is? No. And that's where we turn to a quote from Damon Lindelof in this article. The answer, as corny as it sounds, was the one that appealed to me the most, each other. If they hadn't spent all that time on the island, then they would never have been able to forgive themselves for their past sins and break through to some sort of level of self-awakening and forgiveness. So I just want to say this again. The answer, as corny as it sounds, was the one that appealed to me the most. Each other. Is that not what I said when the show ended? That the point of the show was what matters most is other people?
That is pretty much literally what you said, yes.
Confirmed by Damon Lindelof. Now, what is the problem with that? The problem with that is the show the entire time tried to show the value of multiple things. Man of science, man of faith. right? The self and other people. It tried to show the value of both. But when you have an ending like this, what does it undermine, Daniel? Everything else. The self doesn't matter anymore. Doesn't this also explain why Jack was the hero of the show, even though he continued to fuck up over and over again? And, you know, I'm just going to say it was a fucking pussy. Because what did Jack care about most?
What?
What did Jack care about most? What was he most driven by?
Other people.
Right, other people's approval. It wasn't what he thought was right or wrong. It was other people's approval. There was even that great scene in season 5 where Sawyer was like, I think you react. Because that was what Jack did the whole time. So the show, which had all of these amazing things in it about, you know, thinking through the world and understanding the world and figuring out why things are, ultimately said none of that matters. You're never going to be able to understand the world. All that matters is the other people and how they make you feel.
Yeah. Ended in a church.
So philosophically, Daniel, and William, you can jump in here too if you want. What's wrong with that perspective? Let's just tease that out a little bit. Like, I don't want to go into a full-on, like, doctoral thesis here, but just very briefly, what's wrong with that perspective? Especially when he's saying that if they hadn't spent all the time on the island, then they would never have been able... So let me phrase the question this way. Ignoring the first half of his statement, if they hadn't spent all that time on the island, then they would never have been able to forgive themselves for their past sins and break through to some sort of level of self-awakening and forgiveness. That statement on its own is true, correct?
Right, because the island is what helped them explore themselves. Introspection, almost, yeah.
Right, the island presented a unique set of circumstances, and based upon that new set of stimuli, it was able to give them new things to think about with themselves because they reacted to things differently and learned new things.
Yeah.
Isn't it crazy? I mean, William, did you watch Lost?
I think we've talked about it on the show before. I believe the last episode I watched was when the numbers counted down to symbols, and then I turned it off and brushed my hands like this and said, I'm never watching this show again. I got that distinct feeling this was going nowhere fast. And so I exited.
As an outsider, when you see the showrunner say that the answer that appealed to him the most was what was other people, was each other, what kind of a reaction do you have to that?
Well, it sounds like it can fall really easily into a collectivism trap. And, you know, it's a good story is driven by individuals' choices and those reactions on the people, right? You have to have that integrated. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
And that's the insanity, William, Daniel.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, the ending demonstrates how it falls into that collectivism trap, which is the whole other people thing doesn't make a real strong distinguishing features between who those other people are. In fact, one of the psychotic evil people in the show, while he's not in the church at the end, they're like, oh, you'll be here soon. Don't worry. It's like, didn't he kill a bunch of people? Isn't he a mass murdering fuckhead?
Yeah, the genocide. But as long as he worked with Hurley, he'd be fine. You just have more work to do.
That's right. You'll be here soon. Don't worry.
What? Well, and that undermines one of the best moments from earlier in the show, Daniel, what William's talking about. Earlier in the show was the whole live together, die alone. And that came off when it originally happened as, oh, hey, here's this great sort of cliche portrayal of a man trying to lead but not knowing how to lead by saying these cliche, trite things. But then the show comes around at the end, and the series finale, and the sixth season, really, and that's one of the things is, like, the whole sixth season and the last episode seemed to contradict the first five seasons because the first five seasons seemed to be showing how trite and simplistic and unmeaningful that was. And then at the end, it brought that back. The whole idea, if we don't live together, we're going to die alone.
Yeah. By the way, if you watch the first five seasons, you will be, you will have many things unanswered for you at the end of season 5, but it'll be overall a better experience if you just don't watch the sixth season.
Well, I think you can watch the end of the fifth season and it can be a series finale on its own because it has the whole dichotomy with Jacob and the Man in Black. It has the whole when the bomb goes off, the end screen is inverted. So it raises a lot of questions and gives you a lot to think about, but it becomes more of a reflective, like, hey, what was the journey they went on and what mattered and was it real or was it important? All those kind of discussions and what is human nature? Whereas at the end, it's really, really at the end, doesn't it negate the entire show because Jack just ends up back where he started? So he's vindicated at the end by being a pussy who's afraid of everything and wants to fix everything? Because at the end of the show, doesn't he get to quote-unquote fix everything?
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, so now that we've eviscerated Lost 10 years later.
That's the end of the show. We'll talk to you next week.
That would be ending this episode at a church.
Nothing else happened this week.
Nothing else happened this week. I think that something good happened this week as a response to that. Not a direct response, but, you know, we can say, oh, well, Lost was a great disappointment, but I think the opposite happened. I mean, I want to get, before I go into sort of my experiences and everything, I want to go into what you guys thought about what happened. So I want to hear what you guys think about the fact that the Snyder Cut was announced this past week. Zack Snyder had a live stream of Man of Steel. It was a Zoom call. It was hilarious because at the end, Henry Cavill pops up. And you're like, oh, wow, this is actually a Zoom. And they're just streaming Zoom through Vero. And then at the end of it, he was like, I can't show you the movie right now. Like, I've told you, you know, HBO has the rights to that, or AT&T or WB, whoever. It's all, you know, the corporate food chain. But I can show you this. And then he put an image up that showed the Justice League and said HBO Max 2021. Now, I don't think either of you watched it live, but hearing the news and everything that's happened since, what are your guys' experience? Because you've been here for this whole journey.
Well, I didn't watch the whole video, but I did want to go back. And one of the interesting things I wanted to see was people's reactions to it live. So I went back and watched people's camera, like there was a collection of people's camera responses to it, and seeing the joy and happiness on their face was very uplifting. I was really happy I did that. Overall, this, I don't know, maybe it's a weird sense of life thing, or maybe it's a mid-side thing, but I felt like this was inevitable. I just felt like we were just waiting out the irrationality of the world, and eventually reason was going to win out, and eventually this was going to happen, and we were going to stand back and go, yeah, that's what I thought. And so that was kind of my emotional response to it, which was simply, yeah, good, okay, it's time.
Interesting. William, what about you?
I was really happy. I think I've wanted to see this story done better, and while we're not going to exactly get the Snyder Cut everyone was calling for, because it's not really a movie yet, it's going to be interesting.
Okay, I'm going
to
stop you right there. So I didn't want to go into this stuff yet, so put a pin on that. That is part of the spin that has happened post. We are getting more because Snyder was able to negotiate more using the leverage the movement gave him. But there is an actual Snyder Cut. There always was. It just wasn't complete VFX-wise and everything.
Exactly.
But there's a whole detailed discussion about what the actual story is, because if you remember, after Batman versus Superman, they said there's not going to be a part two anymore. Just make one movie and rewrite the script based upon all our notes. So there's a lot of the media, and I think this goes into our earlier discussion, has been messing around with this stuff. But just put a pin in that and continue.
Okay, well, because that's kind of where I was going to go. I was
then go there.
Also not surprised by the media's reaction. This is I don't know, I've seen different descriptions. What's the best one? One was, this was toxic fandom. This is an example of toxic fandom. In other words, anytime fans get what they ask for, what they will actually be willing to pay for, unlike when social justice warriors ask for changes and then don't buy the product once it's changed. So this is somehow toxic fandom winning, or a victory for white supremacy, which I shit you not, I saw on Twitter people saying that this was a victory for white supremacy. So mirroring the New York Times article. This in the military. So like we're kind of like hitting fire on all cylinders right now. The all those white people out there, wherever they are.
Okay, and that's exactly where I wanted to go to, William, because I think the two things you just said aren't that far apart. And I think it's related to something Daniel said earlier on the show, but I think they're not that far apart. And I think all of these vloggers covering this, who haven't been involved this whole time, as certainly as involved as we are, right? Because how long have we been talking about Zack Snyder on the show, Daniel? The entire run of the show for 8 years now?
It's been pretty close. It's been pretty close.
Right. Yeah. I went back and I looked, and my first Zack Snyder tweet was 2011. And we started the series, the Snyder series, in 2013, I believe, right after Man of Steel. Wow. But we were analyzing his work even before then and talking about his work even before then. I mean, I know when I was in grad school at Clemson, I wrote an analytical piece for the alternative newspaper about Watchmen and how Watchmen was all about how we watch the Watchmen. And that's the ultimate answer. And I still think that's the point of Watchmen, is every individual watches the Watchmen. And that's the only way, is if you have self-responsibility rather than the whole cynical approach of Alan Moore, that nobody can watch the Watchmen, and that's why power is evil, and that goes to nihilism. But that's the point, is if you haven't been involved in this for a long, and then you're talking about it, you're coming in and you're just going, oh man, they're just calling fandom toxic for getting what they want. I think it's more complicated than that. I saw one take where they were saying, oh well, these media people are just upset that they're being bypassed now, because they got this position where they could tell the studio what the fans want. But now the fans can do it directly. And I think it's more complicated than that as well. I think it's all part of it. But what I think it is, Daniel, and I'm throwing this to you specifically because you have experience with this, with how you were going to get a PhD in some of the applications. People go into media not to report, but to forward an agenda. And they think that anyone who doesn't agree with their agenda and forward their agenda is, as William said, a white supremacist, is a fascist. And it's especially when you have a filmmaker like Zack Snyder, who makes films that are essentially rooted in individualism. Isn't that what's going on here? The reason they're attacking here is this was not just a victory for Zack Snyder and getting the DC movies out. Because I do think there's a portion of people who support this, a large portion, who don't understand that pragmatically they're just DC fans and they wanted a DC movie out. And they're missing the forest for the trees. Isn't that why the media is fighting back so hard, Daniel? Because the win is a win in reality. It shows that, as you said, Daniel, very well stated, we were just waiting out reality. We were waiting out for rationality to take hold, that somebody would say, wait, this can make us money. It's already a sunk cost. Let's negotiate and figure out how we cannot waste this footage, which is a completely different story than what was in theaters. Because in theaters was about 20% of Zack Snyder's actual footage and 20% of his story. Maybe it was the basic beats of the mother boxes and everything, but it was not anywhere close to his actual story. So we were waiting for rationality to win out. You know, then it happened with the streaming wars and HBO Max needing content and COVID and everything. Everything happened in a way that made it so reality couldn't be denied. And so it was shown that all of the people like me, like you, like William, who wanted to release the Snyder Cut, had reality on their side. And the other people who didn't were anti-reality. They were failures, basically. So they lost credibility. So they had to find a way to undermine the credibility of the other people. And this is where the rhetorical game comes in. They had to make it about the agenda again. Oh, well, yeah, they got what they want. They were able to succeed better in reality, but that's because they're evil people, and we can't let this evil system last anymore. And isn't that what social justice warriors do? Unless you fit their social justice agenda, they rhetorically paint you as evil. Isn't that what's really going on with all these people that are attacking everything that William's talking about?
That was the longest leading question in the history of the
Midside.
I think
we've got the Guinness Book of World Records folder right here. I mean, we have to keep in mind.
So I think my response, Justin, is yes.
Well, no,
ladies and gentlemen,
like,
I am not a genius.
That was the worst time to play that. No, I want to know your thoughts, Daniel, and your experience.
I know. Obviously, you asked about 71 questions in that,
right.
in that string
I mean,
setup.
I'm just sharing my experience very passionately. I'm not speaking as logically here right now. And what I want to know is your experience, because you tend to be more cool-headed. You're more emotionally distant than I am from this, and you're more rhetorically savvy. Is this a social justice attack, or am I imagining that? Maybe that's the core question.
No, I definitely think it is. I think it's not just about, well, I'll put it this way. It is about individualism and collectivism. I sometimes struggle if some of these pundits think on that level, or if it's sort of implicit in them. And I think for the most part, it's more implicit in them.
I agree.
But some of the explicitness here is, director like Joss Whedon versus director like Zack Snyder, and the naturalism and romanticism and the making heroes, you know, more realistic and less romanticized, and why that's important. And so you have all these different levels of debates. And so those critics, they had to make themselves right for the sake of their own implicit philosophies, because if they were wrong, if reality contradicted them, then they were going to have to find some way to cover that. Now you're going to see in the next several weeks, we've already started to see what that covering is going to be. This is toxic fandom, this is white supremacy, this is whatever. And those ideas that were much more implicit as part of the argument are going to become much more explicit, because they have to be more pointed. Because this thing is going to happen, so it has to be attacked with sharper sticks.
And there actually was an article, Daniel, NBCNews.com, about the collectivism versus the individual thing. Here's the headline and the subheadline. HBO's Snyder Cut of Justice League won't be able to fix such a collective Hollywood failure. Here's the subheadline. To the extent that Justice League says anything, it says that an individual hero like Zack Snyder can't save anything on his own. And then here's a quote from the article. Justice League is a movie about how everyone needs to team up to save the day. First of all, how do you know what the Snyder Cut's about? It's not out yet. Like, okay, maybe that's what Joss Whedon's was about. But we don't know what the Snyder Cut's about. It's not out. I can tell you what it's probably about, because I've had conversations with people about, like, the anti-life equation and what that means and how that fits into Lois is the key and all of that. But that's, like, deep, like, down the rabbit hole of analysis. Not the rabbit hole as in conspiracy theory, but, like, being a writer who's trained and has analyzed Zack Snyder for over a decade, I can infer what's going to happen and what things are going to be about, and talking to other fans with that level of knowledge as well. But how do they know? Anyway, continuing the quote. In that sense, it's an allegory for the way that blockbuster franchises are collective projects rather than the product of an individual plan. To the extent that Justice League says anything, it says that an individual hero like Zack Snyder can't save anything on his own. Okay, two things. First of all, isn't the problem with the Justice League theatrical cut that it was a collective project? You had Geoff Johns in there, you had Joss Whedon in there, you had the studio in there. Because look, we have our problems with Joss Whedon, but they handcuffed him as well. He had a lot of notes he had to follow as well, so that wasn't even like a pure Whedon project. So I don't want to like drag Whedon completely through the mud. There were a lot of things that he couldn't execute either.
Yeah, this was very heavily involved. The studio was very heavily involved.
Right, so we saw what a collective project looks like. And then the second thing is, who was leading this movement from the beginning? Everyone loves to claim certain people and they love to name names. But if you look at any of those names that you name, who was the person behind them propping them up? Zack Snyder. So he literally saved the movie. But I'm going to ask you guys a question. Am I crazy here, or is none of this possible without Zack Snyder?
I think it's him and his audience and his fans that have made this possible.
With the unifying factor being him, it's always the string that you can pull that unravels the you didn't build that argument. But it predates Obama and his comment. But it's always the thing like, well, you know, so and so who invented what was it? Sorry, Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine. That's what I was trying to think of. Well, he couldn't have done that without his teachers, and he couldn't have done that without his parents, and he couldn't have done that without the public roads to get to the hospital where he did his research, etc. And the string that you pull there that unravels all of that nonsense, which most people fall into, is that other people have those things. Other people have access to those resources. Other people have more access to resources than perhaps Jonas Salk did. And yet, no one invented the polio vaccine before Jonas Salk. Why? Because it took him, the individual, and his mind in a particular circumstance to create this thing. What I'm saying is, Zack Snyder is the Jonas Salk of filmmaking. That's what I'm saying right now. No. My point is... my point is that you can talk about how things are a collective product or whatever, fine. Fancy up your rhetoric. The one string you can pull is that this particular thing wouldn't happen without this individual. Period. The end. That's all there is to it. Your whole argument falls apart.
Right. And to use another metaphor, it's like Jenga. If you pull that one piece out, everything else falls. Yeah, we saw it. Right? We saw what happened. You took the Zack Snyder Jenga piece out and you ended up with the theatrical cut. Look at it. Now, without the other pieces on top of it, you know, maybe Batman's not as good if you don't have Affleck, right? Maybe Wonder Woman's not as good as you if you don't have Gal Gadot. But they're not the essential piece that you pull out and the tower collapses. And doesn't this make it tremendous? And again, doesn't it show that Zack Snyder is one step ahead of this? By naming it Zack Snyder's Justice League? Hasn't he already prevented or hasn't he already presented the refutation to all of these arguments?
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic.
Oh, it just really bugs me. Two things really bug me. One, people who supported this movement who won won't ignore the negative people now, won't ignore these attacks because you just give them more power when you ignore them and treat them as credible. They've already lost. It's like you told them the wind is coming and they didn't believe you and they pissed into it and they're still pissing in the wind and you're mad at them for pissing into the wind. It's like all they're doing is getting pissed on themselves and yet you're arguing with them as if they actually can hurt you. And then the second thing is I think people just not identifying what's really going on is a huge missed opportunity. I think, William, is this not in the same tradition as Gamergate? Is this not similar?
Yeah, we'll see the similar plays come out, right? If you watch this and enjoy it, you're a white supremacist. There'll be calls for Snyder just being a dumb frat boy, right? And we'll see the Rotten Tomatoes score, I'm sure, mismatched, right? It'll be, I'm going to predict now the critic score will be somewhere in the 20s and 30s. I'll say 28. And then we'll see if it's, you know, hopefully it's good. So hopefully we'll see a fan somewhere in the 80s. But despite all that, I bet this makes some money for HBO Max. And that'll be the real sort of answer, right? Is that if he puts out a quality product and it makes some money, cool, right? That's what this is about. This is about getting art that the fans want to consume out in the world. And for Snyder, there's fireworks going on in the background. The dog's a little concerned. And for Snyder, this is about getting his vision out into the world.
Well, and that's the question I have for you guys. You know, one of the things that's coming out now, and William, you didn't say this, but it's kind of an implication of something you said where you were like, well, if it's good. And people are like, how do you know it's going to be better than the theatrical cut? That's one of the arguments being used. You know, I'm not a big fan of Dawn of the Dead. I'm not a big fan of The Guardians of Ga'Hoole, the Owl movie. But has Snyder put out a bad movie, Daniel? Like, we know that this is going to be at least intelligible. It's going to be well-produced. Whether it's his best film, whether it's an amazing film, whether it's Oscar-worthy, he's never put out a bad film. Like, do we expect he's going to put out a bad film?
No, I don't expect he's going to put out a bad film, and I hope HBO doesn't hamstring him in any way that would release another Snyder cut. I can see it.
Somebody
now.
Sent me a comment, Daniel, where somebody was like, "Man, I hope WB can use this as an opportunity to rewrite some of the stuff Snyder wanted to do."
But no, he's not released a bad film. Even the Guardians film is not a bad film, and Dawn of the Dead is not a bad film. But here's the thing: I didn't watch Justice League, but the bits I watched and what I've read about it, it's barely a film.
I'm gonna stop you. I love the fact that you and Zack Snyder are the only two people who have not seen the theatrical release of Justice League.
But it's because I've seen parts of it and it looks like an atrocity. It looks like a mishmashed nothing. It's as if you took a McDonald's hamburger and a Whopper and a Wendy's burger and you sort of mash them all together and you were like, "Here's your burger." It's like, well, if Zack Snyder's going to make his own burger, what if it's worse than this burger? Well, this mishmash of a monstrosity isn't really even a burger. It's just, you know, it looks kind of like a burger, but it's horrible. Why would I even want to eat that?
Right. So what
I'll
we
take
have
a
now...
bad burger made by this guy over here, as long as it's an actual burger.
Right. It's a, what was in theaters wasn't really a movie is what you're saying. So even if Zack Snyder just makes a movie, it's guaranteed to be better because it's a movie.
Because it's a frackin' movie. Yeah. As opposed to a studio marketing piece.
Yeah. Well said. Well said about the studio marketing piece. And I think that's why the social justice warriors are upset. I think they're upset because when it was a marketing piece, they could use that to influence to put their ideas forward. And I think they've always been threatened by Zack Snyder. This has been going on for years. This has been going on since before Man of Steel. Did we not see this with Watchmen? Did we not see this with Sucker Punch? That they were threatened by these ideas. I mean, the crazy thing about Sucker Punch is, isn't Sucker Punch an insanely feminist movie?
In the proper sense, yeah.
Yes. But it's so individualistic that they can't handle that. That actually supports what they want. The fact that people like Anita Sarkeesian attack it. I mean, her attack on that movie is the biggest evidence I can give that these kind of attacks have been going on against Zack Snyder for years. And it's time, I think, to acknowledge it.
Why doesn't Hollywood make films with strong female leads? No, not that one.
Yeah. Right. And you have a release of Snyder Cut supporters have a opportunity now to go in a direction. Any direction you want, right? You've achieved your goal, so you can do whatever you want with your life now. And my supposition is, don't make this solely about DC Comics. Like, I'm really disappointed that there are people out there who are immediately pivoting to release the Ayer Cut. Oh, we want to see the cut of Suicide Squad. I'd watch it. I'm not going to lie. I would watch that. I think it will be a better movie, and I think many of the same problems hampered David Ayer. But I think the cultural context of what happened to that movie is much different than what happened with Justice League and what happened with Zack Snyder, especially if you factor in what happened with his daughter. I think there were much more insane things going on there. So that's why I believed in release the Snyder Cut so strongly, and I don't believe in release the Ayer Cut the same way. And I think it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, William, but I think it sort of weakens release the Snyder Cut if you immediately pivot to release the Ayer Cut. It makes it seem like you weren't really about what you said you were about. It was just about, like, because all these people are like, oh, artistic freedom and blah, blah, blah. To me, it seems like, oh, you just want to see DC movies and you didn't like those movies and you think there are better versions out there.
Well, I think we can add one more group that I don't like to that mix. And that's, you didn't see that the Ghostbusters 2016 folks threatened to release like a 3-hour cut of Ghostbusters 2016?
Yeah, Paul Feig did that as well.
Yeah, so... Yeah, we definitely want to see the longer version of that movie, right?
Right. I mean, and that's the point is, hey, let anyone release whatever they want, right? I think we all agree that if they want to release the pure artist vision of any film, it should be out there. If an artist wanted to make it and it wants to be released, then they can make the deal with the studio, put it out there. But the support release the Snyder Cut, Daniel, was never just, oh, hey, Paul Feig didn't get his 3-hour cut of Ghostbusters. It was something else, wasn't it?
I think it was. Again, most people don't speak explicitly, so it was sort of an implicit, something is wrong with this that's so different from Zack Snyder, what I know about Zack Snyder, right? Like, I get something from his films that I'm not getting from this. So why not let him do his film so I can get the thing that I get from Zack Snyder films? And for us, obviously, that's a celebration of individualism, it's romanticism, it's this particularly stylized kind of art that we like. My point is why are studios not taking advantage of this in general in an era where, fine, release a theatrical version or whatever you want to do, but like, give the directors the rights to release their version and not just a quote unquote director's cut, which is typically just a longer version of the theatrical version, but the story, however they want it to be told on some streaming service, sell it to Netflix, sell it to Hulu, start your own streaming service where once these movies are released in theaters and this is the theatrical cut, now this is the way Paul Feig really wanted it to be seen. Now give us more money to see that version. But it seems like they're just leaving money on the table here for people who, by the way, would pay more money to see these things.
Right. No, 100%. Especially with these streaming services out now, you can very easily say, okay, Zack Snyder, this is what you want to shoot. We'll let you shoot these extra alternative scenes that we will put only on HBO Max, as long as you also shoot these scenes for us that will go into the theatrical cut that will be released in theaters. Now you're going to have to negotiate and make sure things aren't too different, right? Because there's budgeting issues here, there's scheduling issues here, but it can be done in a way that you can have both of those. You can have, here's the perfect example of this, Sucker Punch. The ending that was shown in theaters, the version that was shown in theaters and even the extended cut, is the studio watered down version where they wanted the voiceover at the beginning and the end. It neuters the film a little bit. Snyder said it's not as hard on the fanboys as he wanted it to be, but it's still basically the same movie. You could just say that. He did shoot both. He shot the musical number at the end that hasn't been done yet because of VFX. So why could you not do that? Say, okay, here, you go out and you shoot your original version and do these few extra scenes, and then if we need reshoots, we already do reshoots on all major pictures, so here's some reshoots you can do, and just make it so you say, HBO Max, the only place where you can see the artist's true vision, versus here's the theatrical cut for everybody else. Aren't you going to make more money that way, and it's going to be less of an investment?
Totally. Totally. There's any number of models you could do. You could do it as a crowdfunding model. Once we get X number of people to buy a ticket for the Zack Snyder version of Justice League, then we'll green light the finishing of it or whatever it is. Like, there's a gajillion models for this. And I think, speaking of inevitable, it's probably inevitable that this happens. I just don't know HBO Max took a big leap forward in it, but I don't know which other major studios are going to adopt a more artist-centric model, since that's what people want.
Disney's going to have to pivot to it eventually, because Disney's really seeing the success of The Mandalorian, which is more artist-centric. And aren't they even bringing in like Robert Rodriguez for season 2 and things like that?
Yeah, man, watching the behind-the-scenes making of The Mandalorian, I think I like the making of The Mandalorian more than The Mandalorian. Because it was a group of people who actually understood Star Wars, and Kathleen Kennedy basically left them alone, which was fantastic. The movies, in comparison, are again a studio atrocity, a marketing piece, and not really movies at all. Anyway, that's a whole. We could do a whole show on that topic, but let's not do it now.
Right. No, certainly. And the point is, there are larger discussions to be had here, and I just hope people realize them and they listen to what we're saying here, because I find it disappointing that people are pivoting so quickly to release the air cut, or people are so reliant. And I didn't like from the beginning that people were like, this is about artistic freedom. No, from the beginning, and here's how we can put a cap on this, and you guys can add anything you want to this, but from the beginning, what this was about for me was Zack Snyder is a unique director. And I may have felt the same way if this was Christopher Nolan as well. But Zack Snyder is a unique director. He's an important director. I think he's a very American director in the tradition of Americanism. And because of that, this film needed to be released because it deserved to be released for Zack Snyder and, more importantly, for myself. I deserve to enjoy his art. And the fact that there was a piece of art by an important artist out there that hadn't been released, that was what this was about. And I think it undermines the cause and undermines the value if you start saying, oh, well, no, these other things are equal to this. They are not. Even if they get released, it will never be equal to what happened and what will be released because of who Zack Snyder is and the art he makes. And I think that is the value and that is the accomplishment and that is the victory here. I think this was a major, major, major cultural victory.
Huzzah. Enjoy it.
All right, gentlemen. What did we learn this trip? William?
I learned that the Snyder Cut is a trap.
How did you not get that drop? We need to get the It's a Trap drop from now on because that can be a new thing on the show.
All right,
Daniel. What'd you learn?
I learned that as airlines continue to treat us as infants, eventually we're going to revert to nap times with milk cartons on every flight over 2 hours. Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned that, honestly, from what you just said, I was probably ahead of the curve because I like to fly on red eyes because everyone else already is during nap time. So maybe I was already treating people like infants on airplanes.
We hope you learned something this week here on The Midside. Go to themidside.com/podcast to learn even more by listening to older episodes of the show going all the way back to God knows when. But I was searching. I think the first mention of Snyder on the website is July 2014 in an article that Justin wrote about Transformers, I think, and comparing parts of it to Man of Steel. So go back and read that and listen to past episodes of the show. While you're there, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating. Helps us move up the rankings, find new audiences. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us on their stream. Much appreciated. Libertarians, check out Joe Jorgensen. Who else do I need to thank? Oh, patreon.com/themidside. Give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. It helps us keep the lights on. Although we need fewer lights in the summer, but still.
This concludes your journey into The Midside.
All right.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Way to step on it, Justin.
Waiting patiently for that email from Spotify inviting us to go exclusive to them, just like Joe Rogan.
But most importantly, you can tell a friend about the show. Telling a friend is the most important way that your friends find out about the show. But until next time, we love you.
Oh, is that what you were trying to say?
As I've said every week for 7 years.
Justin, honestly, also didn't introduce any segment like he normally does. I think he's got the COVID, man. I think he's got the cover.
Yes. His transition was music now.
He's become, who's the guy from like that Sunday PBS show? He's become that guy.
Justin is pointing at William through the glass, despite the fact that he is halfway, or no, totally across the country, and there is no glass.
Oh my God.